So, Caleb, what is this little mysterious book that we are talking about today?
It's Cautionary Tales and Bad Child's Book of Beast by Hilaire Belloc. And I've got to say, this is the first book I could read to my daughter.
Yeah.
And we both loved it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. We both loved it. Now, like I said, my daughter is running around.
Yeah.
Just like me.
Slamming doors.
Slamming.
Stirring.
I mean, she's just constantly on the go. And so it's not easy for you to read a book to her, mm-hmm. unless they're like super kiddie books.
Yeah.
So this one we had to do like about 8:30 at night, but mm-hmm. right before we went to bed, when she's laying in bed.
I think that reading to our kids does way more than we think it does. There's a lady who was on Matt Frad's podcast, Pines with Aquinas, Read Aloud Revival. And some of the stuff that she says is wild about how much the language affects our children and how much they soak in that we don't even realize. I hope one day that a podcast is big enough that we could have her on. Because I feel like it would fit right in with our brand here.
Okay. You know?
But yeah, sorry.
No, that's right. Yeah, I'm sure it does something. It's just in those moments when
she's not taking the moral out of it.
No.
Or if there is a moral to be had, she's not really soaking that in.
She's like,
you know?
Funny picture.
Yeah, right.
And maybe by the time she's, you know, 3 or 4, she'll start really soaking them in. So I'm excited to go through this journey with her. The whole reason that we're doing this, and at Lucy, if you ever listen to this, or Margaret, the whole reason we're doing this is for y'all.
Oh, yeah.
Because we want our daughters to be able to listen to this one day and see what their dad thought and see how important it was for their dad to read to them. And it's one of my favorite things to do with Lucia is just spend that time with her.
Every night. That's something that Marissa and I, we made a point to do. That's a part of the bedtime routine is a book. It doesn't matter how short it is or how goofy it is. Now we've read a couple books and be like, yep, never going to read that one again. But it's every night she gets a story.
This is like the introduction to the Bad Child's Book of Beasts. And it says, I call you bad, my little child, upon the title page, because a manner rude and wild is common at your age. The moral of this priceless work, if rightly understood, will make you from a little Turk unnaturally good. Do not as evil children do, who on the slightest grounds will imitate the kangaroo with wild unmeaning bounds. Do not as child badly bred who eat like little hogs, and when they have to go to bed while whine like puppy dogs, who take their manners from the apes, their habits from the bear, indulge the loudly unseemly jape and never brush their hair. But so control your actions that your friends may all repeat, this child is dainty as a cat and as an owl discreet.
Yeah.
That's Hilaire Belloc. And as soon as I was reading this to my wife, our daughter comes bouncing through the living room as a kangaroo. Literally at that point, my wife's like, there's that.
Yeah. Well, that goes along with the other intro to the first part of the book, The Cautionary Tales, is he kind of says like, hey, the things in these books, we've all done them. And if these things were true, we'd all be dead, you know, but take what you take from them kind of thing. This is the intro that Belloc did to Cautionary Tales.
Upon being asked by a reader whether the verses contained in this book were true, and is it true, is it not true, and if it were, it wouldn't do for people such as me and you, who pretty nearly all day long are doing something rather wrong. Because if things were really so, you would have perished long ago. And I would not have lived to write the noble lines that meet your sight, nor BTB survived to draw the nicest things you ever saw.
Which I don't know if they're the nicest things. I think that's good, especially for kids. It kind of sets up the imagination, like, hey, this isn't real, but let's have some fun with it. And I really think that's what Belloc did here, because some of these, I laughed out loud, especially when I read the headings.
Oh, yeah, which give it away.
It tells you what's going to happen.
He's very clear, like, this is the whole point.
Yeah. And so this book, it's just poetry. It's poetry for children. Poetry to be read to children. And so a cautionary tale is just something, there's a lesson to be learned. Like, for instance, one of the cautionary tales is slamming doors. A little girl keeps slamming doors. And the whole cautionary tale is about why you shouldn't slam doors. Slamming doors is super annoying, and I want you to stop. And so he writes the whole tale about it. And so that's all a cautionary tale is.
And the tale is entitled, Rebecca Who Slammed Doors for Fun and Perished Miserably.
Yeah, perished miserably. So detailed. And I just chuckled to myself on several of these.
Well, and I felt like these all had beautiful insight because I am this father. I'm 100% this father to my daughters. They will attest to that. You need to stop doing that. If not, you'll die. You know?
That is definitely you.
You need to quit doing this right away or you'll fall down, hit your head, and die. So I love this book because I immediately recognized it as tales I would tell my daughter.
Well, I feel like the best children's stories are, and I feel like this is way with film too, is the parents can read or watch and kind of chuckle to themselves because there's not necessarily anything dirty or like any sexual innuendos, but there's just like funny things, funny jokes that maybe a child won't pick up on. So it kind of makes it for the, it makes it fun for the parent too, as well as the kid. And I feel like that this does this in several ways because a lot of the stories in here, he's kind of making fun of English aristocratic culture to a certain degree, which is funny, you know?
And all of these are just true. I mean, they're all funny. The only thing I'm not sure of whether or not it's true, but I've heard this before in the past and it made me look at my daughter differently, was chewing on a string. I'm like, oh wait, yeah, they probably shouldn't be chewing on strings.
That one was oddly specific. So I feel like this must have happened to Belloc. He must have experienced, he had a nephew or a kid that just incessantly ate string.
Yeah. He was like, kid, knock it off or you'll die. It'll get tied up in your stomach.
Yeah.
But I will say that when I saw my daughter playing with the string, it made me go, hey, don't you put that in your mouth. And it had an effect on me in that way. One of my favorites was the very first one, which was Jim, who ran away from his nurse and was eaten by a lion.
And it is exactly like what it sounds like.
Yeah, it is. And I love this because there's a point when you're reading this to your daughter or your sons, if you're, you know, so blessed to have sons as well, when you're like grabbing their feet as it's, and my wife, when she's hearing these stories, she thinks they're super graphic. And I'm like, these are just fairy tales and good poetry. So Jim, there was a boy whose name was Jim. His friends were very good to him. They gave him tea and cakes and jam and slices of delicious ham and chocolate with pink inside and little tricycles to ride and read him stories through and through and even took him to the zoo. But there it was that dreadful fate befell him, which I now relate. You know, at least you ought to know, for I have often told you so, that children never are allowed to leave their nurses in a crowd. Now this was Jim's special foible. He ran away when he was able. And on this inauspicious day, he slipped his hand and ran away. He hadn't got a yard when, bang, with open jaws a lion sprang, and hungrily began to eat the boy, beginning at his feet. Now just imagine how it feels when first your toes and then your heels, and then by gradual degree, your skin and ankles, calves and knee are slowly eaten bit by bit. No wonder Jim detested it. No wonder that he shouted, hey! The honest keeper heard this cry. Though very fat, he almost ran to help the little gentleman. Ponto, he ordered as he came, for Ponto was the lion's name. Ponto, he cried with angry frown. Let go, sir. Down, sir. Put it down. The lion made a sudden stop. He let the dainty morsel drop, and slunk reluctant to his cage, snarling with disappointing rage. But when he bent over Jim, the honest keeper's eyes were dim. The lion having reached the head, the miserable boy was dead. When nurse informed her parents, they were more concerned than I can say. His mother, as she dried her eyes, said, well, it gives me no surprise. He would not do as he was told. His father, who was self-controlled, bade all children round attend to James's miserable end, and always keep a hold of nurse for fear of finding something worse. And that's something with toddlers that we can most certainly relate to.
I figured that one would identify with you and Rosemary, you know, with the age that your daughter's at.
Especially because she's in the habit now of when Rosemary comes home and gets the little one out of the car and gets Lucia out as well. Lucia has been like taking off towards the street, which is a certain no-no. You definitely shouldn't do that. So I've loved telling her this tale and running my fingers, you know, like through her toes and ankles and shins and knee when it makes that part. It's just so vivid and such a good description and just a beautiful tale. That's true. We should stay with the person we came. There is a real danger in the world. You shouldn't run in front of cars, Lucia.
Don't do it.
And don't run.
Or die.
Yeah. Don't run around the lion. And I love at the end that the dad is the sensible one who says, bring all the kids here, you know.
Yeah.
Let them come to the funeral to witness what has happened about this story.
One thing that, like I feel like Rosemary's initial reaction, and I feel like because our culture is so, not dumbed down, but kind of, there's no, like, violence for kids. Like, all of our fairy tales, they've stripped all of the evil out of them. And I feel like this story is very, it's almost graphic in a way. Like, imagine how it feels to be eaten from your heels to your shins and all the way up to your head, right?
I thought it was delightful at that point. Yeah.
That might be a problem with you, man.
Well, I mean, just because it's so, it just automatically brings that image to your mind and creates this feeling.
Well, it drives home the point
of
the whole story.
Well, and it's the imagination. Anything that reworks that, rebegins that in me.
Yeah.
Who's had my imagination tarnished by, you know, loose TV shows, as we'll say. I mean, that's why I find it delightful, because it's like, it's working like it should at one point.
I've heard people talk about it, but I wanted to find a source that talks about why is it good for our kids to read things like this, to read the Grimm's fairy tales where the witch is eating kids, right? And like, why is that okay? And why should we do that? And I couldn't find anything. So if there's any listeners out there who knows of a source, I would love to know about it. Because it's super interesting of the topic of, because initially I'm like, no, I don't want my kids to hear that.
Yeah.
Like, why should they hear that? They're kids. They don't need to worry about that.
See, to me, that's the real world.
Yeah.
You know, like there is evil. There's certainly evil out there. Now, I draw the line at my kids reading something that's unnatural or unreal. If there's something that doesn't fit in reality, that's incomprehensible to them, I leave those out. That's why I'm not a big fan of Dr. Seuss. We try not to read Dr. Seuss with our kids because it's just nonsense for nonsense sake.
Yeah, it's very out there. There's nothing to ground it. Like, I mean, fantasy is fantasy, right? There's going to be things that aren't necessarily reality, but there's always something in there that ties it back to reality. But with Dr. Seuss, it's like, it's just out there, man. And the rhymes are fun, and they're fun to say sometimes, but there's no...
They mean nothing.
Yeah. And
there's
so it's
no meaning at all. It's like just...
We had one, I don't remember what it's called. It's one of the post Dr. Seuss. It's just like the Dr. Seuss company. I don't even know what you want to call it. I don't think he wrote it, but it literally hadn't, there was no story. Each page was something different, rhyming for rhyming's sake, nonsense for nonsense sake. And it was just, this is as one of the books, like I said earlier, we're never going to read this one to her again because this is pointless.
It's just like our throwaway culture. Here's nonsense for nonsense sake. It's just media for media's sake.
Yeah.
It's books for book's sake. So that's kind of where I draw the line. Now, there are witches out there who wish to eat children. And knowing this, there's something to say about the stress of this leading you to grow in yourself and your strength. I'm not saying it the right way, but we're living in one of the most anxious civilization that there's ever been in the world. And yet we're not even dealing with plagues that kill people or barbarians who come and siege our capital and rape our women.
Yeah.
We're not dealing with those kinds of things. And so there's something to be said about resiliency of people who have real lives and live in reality and know that there are bad people and bad people possibly want to hurt them and do them harm.
Yeah.
And that helps them actually overcome these things, this fear, versus our society who isn't dealing with that for the most part. Or is only dealing with it in different ways and undercover ways that we don't necessarily know about. But it's not as clear. And so we're not going through this stress that every other civilization has. And so we have the most anxiety of any civilization that's ever existed.
Yeah.
Because we haven't had to see that normal stress that everybody once lived under of, man, your mom just died because she was giving birth to kids. Like, that was very normal, you know?
Well, normal in the sense that it happened more regularly and that something you had to deal with. But, like, it wasn't normal in the sense that, like, people didn't care.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It was talked about differently. It was looked about differently. I think
it was talked about as a possibility. Like, this could happen. Like, today's world, it's like, there's risks involved with
childbirth.
There's
people today who think that they will live forever.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people that think that they will never die. Now, if the second coming happens, happy day.
Yeah, right.
You know, that'll be wonderful. Lord, please let us be in a state of grace and welcome us into the heavenly kingdom body. And so we might never have to go through it. That'd be wonderful. But there are problems in the world. And I think knowing these things makes us stronger. Living in reality makes us stronger. Knowing that a plague could very well come and take us down, or you could get polio, or your mom could pass away, or any of these hard things.
Yeah.
You see the opposite extreme in firefighters and police officers, unfortunately, who see death so much, or morticians who see death so much that it becomes almost trivial, and that's just the way that they cope with it because they have to. How else are you going to deal with seeing a dead person on the side of the road twice a week?
Yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, I went to go to be an MT and do the firefighter thing. Like, my dad was a firefighter, and that's I think that's one of the things that I don't think it was for me, because I can't imagine doing that. Like, it just wasn't for me, and that could be because I've never had to see it or deal with death as much as some people have, and some people are just built for it. But it is true of our culture that, you know, we see death on the TV screen and all the time. We see the gory deaths, the heads blown off, and all the rated R stuff we see in action movies. But to see that in real life is so much different. So we're so desensitized that when we actually experience true loss in a death that's that gruesome, or we have any of that trauma, it's like world shattering.
We have sanitized death. So I don't want to be embalmed. I'll say that out loud now, which is one of those weird things that I've said, and it's because we don't deal with death anymore. St. Alphonsus Liguori has a wonderful book called Preparation for Death, and then he takes you through these meditations every day. And he goes through one of these meditations, and he says, on the first day, everybody comes down to your house, and they are there with you and your dad in bed, and they're mourning, and they're praying, and they're staying up the whole night with you. The second day, you begin to stink. And then by the end of the second day, you've turned a little bit of shade of white. You begin to turn green and mold. The third day, you stink so bad, they're just ready to put you in the ground. And that's the reality of death.
Mm-hmm.
But we've sanitized death so much. Now, if a person dies, you're not going to stay by their bedside and experience any of this. No, you're going to ship them off to the mortician, go ahead and cremate them so I never have to see that again, and bring him here, or put formaldehyde through their veins so they can last for a few more days so we can have a good funeral where we can see them and pretend as if they're somehow not dead because their late face looks beautiful. Or maybe this is a sign that they've already entered the beatific vision, that they're smiling. But that doesn't let us hit actually the reality of death.
Yeah, and it's not like you're saying we should sit there and smell our dead loved ones. Like, no, that's not necessarily what you're saying. You're saying that by not having that even in our realm of experience, we lose that reality of death.
Yeah.
That we don't want to remember them like that. We want to remember them living. And it's like you said, when they're going to live forever. I want them to live forever in my mind like that. And it's like, that's not exactly how we should be thinking. Yeah. We should be thinking eternally.
People used to actually, and that's what St. Alphonsus Liguori said, is like, by the third day, you're ready for them to go on the ground. Because they stink and you're like, it's time. There's something about closure there.
Yeah.
Whereas most of the time now, when they're going, especially if they don't have a liturgical burial, if there's no mass with words to be said, if there's no funeral, if there's no going into the ground, psalms to be said, and the family there, and there's a way that we do these things, a lot of times in Protestant circles and Protestant funerals, it's chaotic. And there's nothing to do, and nobody really knows what to do. There's no right or wrong. Maybe you'll recite Psalm 23. Maybe you'll do that. Or maybe you'll come up and you'll get yelled at to come help lower the casket into the burial before anybody's there.
Yeah.
I've been at a funeral like that that was kind of traumatic because of that. Because there was nothing said. It was like, hey, come get the casket. We're lowering it into the ground.
Yeah,
you better come help. And the best that you can get secular-wise, because I've been to secular funerals where they weren't religious at all and had nothing religious said at them, the best I've seen secular-wise are the military funerals, because at least then they'll have the gun salute and they'll have a person say something. But even that's lackluster.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing that gets them lowered in.
Well, because we've been talking about, you lose this vision of eternity, and you lose the vision of the heavenly realm and what we're striving for. Like, yo, they just died. Their body's gone. You know, oh, they're in heaven. You know, you kind of lose the,
that's
not
the
not the risk, but you lose the weight of it, right?
No, you're right. It is the risk, because everybody will die. And when you experience death more in your life, you realize that you will die. And it's false to not believe that. It's false to think that you will live forever as you are now. Now, you will die. And that means you better get right with the Lord.
Yeah.
Or whoever your creator is, whoever you believe in, that demands something of you. But we're no longer thinking about it. A lot of people, a lot of men become religious for the first time when their dad dies.
Yep.
Because there's the rock that they've realized for the first time. So for me, my brother-in-law died 26 years old. He was younger than me.
Yeah.
And that shook my world. And not that I wasn't already religious, because I was. But then you realize for the first time, not everybody dies at 77.
No.
Not everybody dies at 100.
Yeah. Really coming to grips with, like, your last breath could be in 5 minutes. And understanding that you need to live your life in such a way that if it was, you know where you're going, right? And you need to strive towards that. And to be able to, like we're talking about death, and to be able to accept death in that way is, it seems morbid, but it's so healthy. It's so healthy to realize that this world isn't going to last forever. I'm not going to be here forever. I need to strive for the next one that is going to last forever.
To know where you're going.
Yeah. That vision of eternity. And
it's not YOLO.
No.
Although it is carpe diem a little bit. Yeah. Seize a day. It's not in a new age, new world way. It's not YOLO as in go sleep with whoever you want because you might die tomorrow. And it's not carpe diem as doing the same thing.
Yeah.
But it's certainly don't play video games every day and waste your life. There is a sense of go out and have an adventure.
Be virtuous, you know. Be virtuous. Strive for virtue.
Well, and the adventure is different for the Catholic, for the Christian. Your life should be a wonderful adventure. People should write a story about your life, and at the very beginning of your name, they should have an ST in the front of it.
God willing,
they should tell wonderful tales about you, like Saint Patrick going to Ireland and
converting
the people and creating a whole new alphabet. You know. Converting the whole island where they sing beautiful songs. You can have that life. But you can't have that life if you're going to sit on your phone every day. You can't have that life if you're going to constantly play video games. You can't have that life if you're always going to sit in front of the TV. You can have a beautiful life like St. Louis and St. Zélie, who are the parents of St. Thérèse of Lisieux.
The extraordinary, ordinary life.
Yeah, who lived ordinary lives.
Yep.
Zélie, who dies young.
There's a program called That Man Is You, and I did it with a group of men at my previous parish, and really the only talk video that really stuck with me was the very first one, and it was about the bone church in the catacombs, and it was all about having that eternal mindset, and it's such a morbid thing on the surface of like, wait a second, there's a whole church, and the walls are just made of monks' bones? What is this, some devil worshiping or something? And it's like, no. Memento mori. Like, it that whole concept of like, from ash we came to ash we're going to return. And to really come to grips with your own death. Like, we're dust, right, in this life. So we should be focusing on the next life where we're not going to be. And really wrestling with that concept of, we're going to die one day. Man, this took a turn.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got dark real fast.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm the one who's always like a... I have a medical, what's the word when you always think that you're going to die? You think you have all these diseases?
Hypochondriac?
Oh, yeah, I'm a medical hypochondriac and have medical anxiety all the time. I constantly think, I'm having a heart attack or something.
I'm going to die.
I'm going to die right now.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why, maybe because we don't see death enough and I don't know that it's a real possibility.
Yeah.
But yeah, this certainly took a turn. All right, Rowdy, what was your favorite cautionary tale?
I don't know if this next one was my favorite. I want to bring it up because I found it funny that the punishments in these two stories don't seem to line up with the gravity of what's happening. And it could just be British culture, or it could be something else. I don't know. I just found it interesting. And I thought it'd be fun to talk about. So the first one is called Franklin Hyde, who groused in the dirt and was corrected by his uncle. His uncle came on Franklin Hyde carousing in the dirt, who shook him hard from side to side and hit him till it hurt, exclaiming with a final thud, "Take that, abandoned boy, for playing with disgusting mud, as though it were a toy." The moral: from Franklin Hyde's adventure, learn to pass your leisure time in clearly merriment, and turn from mud and ooze and slime and every form of nastiness. But on the other hand, children in ordinary dress may always play with sand.
I love it.
All right, so this kid, he's in his formal dress and he's playing in the mud, and his uncle basically beats him with a cane. If you see the pictures, he's beating him with a cane. And so this next one
hits him
is called Algernon, who played with a loaded gun and on missing his sister was reprimanded by his father. Young Algernon, the doctor's son, was playing with a loaded gun. He pointed it towards his sister, aimed very carefully, but missed her. His father, who was standing near, the loud explosion chanced to hear, and reprimanded Algernon for playing with a loaded gun.
Bingo.
And so this kid literally shot a gun at his sister and missed her, and his dad was like, shook his finger, don't do that again. And I find it funny at how dramatic those two punishments are for the situation. And I wonder if that's just a culture thing or what.
No, maybe her name was Matilda and she'd been slamming doors. You know, what I love about this book is it tells you a lot about the writer. Because Hilaire Belloc was a grumpy old man, supposedly.
Yeah.
As opposed to, or kind of the foil of G.K. Chesterton, who was always kind of jolly. And so he's the grumpy old man. I think you see the grumpy old man here. He's like, these little kids.
Well, I think also it's dirty. It's that British culture. And I'm getting a little bit of this from watching The Crown, in British culture of how formal it was and how you always need to be the gentleman and you always need to be the lady. And when you're formally dressed, you need to act like a gentleman. And so playing in the mud, you cannot do that or you will be a social leper. Yeah. I'm going to beat you until you get it.
Yep.
But then like playing with a gun is kind of, maybe that scene is like a manly thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that men should do.
He missed his sister, so.
Yeah, but he shot a gun at her. I just find it crazy that all that kid got, instead of a beating with a stick, which that might be justified.
You know, kids forever have been playing cowboys and Indians.
Oh. I don't know. I know that's true, man, but he almost, man. Well, Sally could have been dead.
Yeah, I love that. No, he's kind of a grumpy old curmudgeon, yeah. Which I love. You can tell he's like, basically he is the uncle who, if he sees his nephew out there, he's like, I'm going to beat him.
Yeah.
There is a lot about that, about what's proper in society, mm-hmm. to live. And that's important. It's important to know how to live. There are certain things that are proper in certain societies. There are cultural differences that should be lauded.
I think manners have been something that's lost today.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't have the experience of my dad doing this, but my sister did. It was like if you put your elbows on the table, your elbows got slapped.
Yeah.
Because your elbows don't belong on the table when you're eating. Mm-hmm. That's not good manners. Smacking your lips, all that sort of stuff. It's like, it seems so trivial, but manners are important because it forces you to think about someone else.
Yeah, it's for the other person.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, we no longer know how to eat. And so this is another contrarian thing, I guess. This is just me. We need to go back to old school manners because we no longer know how to eat at a table. Used to, people were, you'd get reprimanded if you got up early from the table. Nowadays, there is no ending to a meal. People just leave.
Yeah.
Which is why it's very important to pray at the end of every meal.
Yeah, that's something we haven't done hardly at all, but it's something that we've talked about doing because I do think that's important of setting the beginning and setting the end and people staying at the table until dinner is done. Even if you're done eating, we're going to sit here as a family,
mm-hmm.
because this is family time.
It sets a precedent. There's also something that's backwards, which is very, very strange to me. And it's something my family does, and I'm sure it's because my parents are very selfless in this. But it's very strange to see, which is, at the table, the first person who goes to get their food should always be the oldest people.
Yeah.
They are the guests. The kids need to wait till the last. There is a pecking order here, literally. There are ones who should go first. There are ones who should go last. And it is not the kids who should go first.
No.
Now, when the older folks defer, okay, maybe they're doing it out of humility. Maybe their whole life they've always gone last. So they will defer because that's what they were taught to do. But at some point, the people who had gone last will be the ones that go first. There's a decorum in how you go and get your food.
It's a natural respect thing. And we do that with my family's meals. We all gather, and my mamma, she goes first, period. Everyone knows that. Mamma goes first because she's the oldest. She's the matriarch, the oldest matriarch of the family. But my aunt, who's kind of more of the active matriarch in the family, she goes last because she's the host, and she wants to make sure everyone is fed before she eats, which is also the respectable thing, like you said.
Yeah.
It's a sign of humility.
It is a sign of humility.
But one thing with that is my sister's little girl, she's coming to learn this. Because we were like, no, you're going to wait. And she was like, why do I have to wait? It's like, well, Mama goes first. And the older folks go first. She's like, well, I should go first. And it's like, no.
Yeah. No, because the problem is if you always defer, if the parents are always saying, you know, being humble to the kids never learn. And so they don't learn what's right to do.
Yeah.
There's no order to the dinner. So, and we see that a lot. My parents, for one, are like, oh, let the kids go first. And I'm like, no, this is the opposite of what needs to happen. y'all need to go first because we need to teach them how to eat at the table. We need to have a prayer after a meal because it ends it. It says, this is how we do things. This is how we sit. This is the things that are acceptable to talk about. This is our posture at the table, and it's for respect for other people.
Yeah.
The older generation has wondered why the younger generation has no respect, and it's because they weren't taught.
Yeah.
Those things used to be built in.
It's still there in some aspects. Like we were talking about the firefighters and things like that earlier. And I know that, like my dad being a firefighter, he would always talk about this because he was a captain at later in his career. And someone, one of the firefighters would cook dinner, and they're trained in academy that you don't eat. You don't sit down to eat and get your plate until the captain does. You stand and you wait. But my dad, he was so laid back and relaxed. He was like, wait, no, I got other stuff to do. Go ahead and eat, you know. But they're like, no, sir. And so they would wait on him, you know. And there's virtue there of putting someone else above yourself. And it's a natural way to do that, you know.
There is a hierarchy. There's hierarchy in all things. We have to realize that. And when we don't realize that, there's chaos because the youngest ones think that they are the oldest. Because they haven't learned the humility that the older ones were taught when they were young by going last. And so they've never learned that. And so they think that they are first. And so you get the spoiled brat grandkids who run up there first and take all the food and go, I'm hungry. I don't care. I'm going to get in line, because they've never learned how to be proper. It's the same thing at the end of meals too. The dishes need to be cleaned after the meals, and there's certain people who need to do it. And when you, if you've never taught that, if you've constantly said, oh, kids don't need to be in the kitchen, let them play, let them run and do that, then they've never learned what to do.
Yeah.
And so when they're 40 years old and their mom is 60 and she's still the one in the kitchen cleaning, and the 40-year-old daughters are slitting on their butt in the living room,
yeah,
that's a problem with the upbringing. Because it was never passed down, what should have been passed down a long time ago, which is that after the meal at a certain point, this will happen. These people will go and will clean the dishes, and that's the way it is.
Or just at the very basic level, like the cook shouldn't clean. You know, whoever cooked your meals, they shouldn't be primarily responsible for cleaning everything up. And I think that's just, that's at a very basic level, right? And something that got me so many brownie points when I met Marissa's parents, and I don't even know how my mom did it. I don't know how I got this value instilled in me. But when I first met them and we would eat dinner at her house and I would finish, I'd say, are you done? And I would take their plates to the kitchen and I would put them up. It got me brownie points, right? And that's probably a selfish, you know, thing for me to do in that sense. But also, I felt as though that was the right thing to do. Me being a guest, they hosting me, they cooked a meal for me that was free. At the very least I could do is grab their plate and take it to the sink. Mm-hmm. I don't have to wash it. I can wash it. And I did that up until we got married. And that was in the speech that her dad gave, was that I continue to do that. And I'm not trying to say the thing of like how great I am, but those things go a long way. When you put others above yourself in something as simple as that. As simple as that.
We've lost the decorum.
Yeah.
We need to regain it.
And I pray that I can do that. I can instill those values in my kid. Of like, yeah, if you're sitting at the table and your grandmother, her glass is empty. Hey, do you want some more? No? Okay, that's fine. But just simply asking that, it means so much.
Yeah. Well, it's hard now because we're living in a traditionless age. We're living in an age when that has all gone out the window. We're living in a traditionless age, unfortunately, where the traditions that are of old, that we've always had, that we've lived with as a society that taught us how to act and how to be, have been purposefully rejected and overturned. It was very common for the woman used to serve her husband. She would actually get the meal. And I hear a story of my uncle who grew up in a household like this. And my aunt, the first time his mom said, hey, aren't you going to serve him? She said, doesn't he have two legs? He can serve himself.
Yeah.
But there was something so beautiful in that. So now the husband and wife are disconnected. And also, there might have been a regulating of food there that might be good to have. But that was a beautiful act of service where people just, that they just did naturally out of love. And then eventually it was shown as a mandated thing, because that's what lovers do, is they serve one another.
Well, there's a story that I heard it and it's kind of stuck with me. The moral that I take away from it is that if there is this pecking order, this hierarchy, when someone at the top steps out of line and kind of puts themselves at the bottom, all of a sudden, there's so much weight to it. So the story goes that a boy was out late, and he was coming home for dinner, and he was late, and they were waiting on him for dinner. And I'm going to paraphrase the story and butcher it, but he was out late, and he came home, and he was late for dinner, and his dad said, next time you do this, you're getting a piece of bread for dinner, and that's it, period. You're not going to have all the meat, potatoes, the greens, anything. It's a piece of bread. Yes, sir. The next night, maybe the next week, he went out again. And he said, all right, you better be back by 7. And 7 o'clock rolled around, and he was running home. He was running home as fast as he could, but he was still late. And he knew that when he got there, he was going to have to eat bread. And so he sat, got home, went to the table. He sat down, and sure enough, his plate, all that laid on it, was a piece of bread. No butter, nothing, just a piece of bread. They prayed, and right before the boy started to eat, the father reached over, grabbed his plate, put it in front of him, and the father put his plate in front of his son, full of all the food, meat, potatoes, and all. And that's kind of where the story ends. And it kind of, and the son was in awe of what his son or his father had just done.
Been showing him mercy and love.
Showing him mercy and love.
Man, that almost teared me up there.
It's an image of Christ.
Yeah.
I'm going to put myself under you, and I'm going to take this punishment for you. I want you to still realize that this is wrong, and I'm going to suffer because of what you've done, but I love you. And I don't want you to have to suffer for these things that you don't know why you're doing them.
That's beautiful. But it only works if you have hierarchy.
Exactly.
There is no humility without hierarchy. The person who is an older aunt or uncle or whatever it may be, who goes last at the end of the meal, is not being humble because there's no order. What they need to first do is go first for years and teach the kids, you go last. There is a pecking order, you go last until you reached our age and our stature and our standing. And then once that person who is first goes last, then it matters. But you can't just overthrow the hierarchy, overthrow the way that we eat, the way that we live, and then expect everything to still remain. No, all of it goes out the window. It's gone. So we no longer know how to eat.
Yeah.
We no longer know the decorum of the table. We no longer know the hierarchy. We no longer know, like, even where to sit. There's not even a hierarchy of seating anymore like there used to be.
Yeah.
Or forks, and we've lost it all.
Yeah. And now, with that being said, that these things are super important, and it seems like the baby was thrown out with the bathwater, because I do think that there's an extreme to this. And I'm going to keep mentioning the crown because it's pertinent to this conversation, but you see these people and how much they hold being proper and not showing emotion and doing the rules black and white, and how much they hold that to a certain high bar, and how that's probably not the best. It's being too legalistic.
You know where it comes from, though? It comes from the monastery. Just as everything else, it all comes from the rule of Saint Benedict.
Yeah.
It's regulated. How do we eat?
Mm-hmm.
Where does the abbot sit?
Yeah.
There is a hierarchy. There is going to be a hierarchy. The question is, will it be run by barbarians or will it be run by rule? Now, of course, that is the bastardization of it, like you're saying.
Yeah,
the
crown, that's what I'm saying. Well, I'm saying that in regard to the kid getting beat by his uncle for getting a little bit of mud on his suit. Should he be reprimanded in trouble? Like, absolutely. Yeah. But is that deserve to be beat with a cane because he's not going to look proper in society and he's a kid? It's like, no. That's too legalistic in my opinion.
Yeah, for a kid.
Now,
it is right to know what's proper to do in each situation, and that brings us right to our next story, which I thought was really good, which is Lord Lundy. I feel like we're going to disagree on this one a little bit. So in the story of Lord Lundy, is Lord Lundy who was freely moved to tears and thereby ruined his political career. And essentially, the whole story is about how it's not proper for men to cry, or at least not to cry
incessantly.
And that's what Lord Lundy does. And he's known as a crier his whole life. And then he gets up to his political career and cries in front of people. And so they keep knocking him down station by station by station. And I love this story, and I thought it was very true. And I've been trying to parse it out because, on the one hand, I think that people no longer have emotions, or they do have emotions, but they don't have strong emotions, because I don't see young men out of love going to battle often. I don't see young men pursuing women out of love. One of the common refrains is, it's easier for me to live in my home and to be on social media than to ever approach a woman and ask her out on a date and possibly be turned down. Which is crazy, because I feel like that's something relatively new. Yes, men used to struggle with that, but that was quickly overcame because they weren't watching porn. They weren't constantly being medicated on their phone.
You had to get over that social anxiety at some point. If you wanted to go talk to a woman,
yeah,
you had to do it.
If you wanted to see a woman in real life naked before you one day, eventually, like, you had to do that. Nowadays, you don't, which is sad. So I think emotions we've kind of lost it. It's just hard because we're living in this malaise. And that's what I was listening to a John Delaney Dr. John Delaney, who's like a Ramsey personality who talks about psychology or whatever. And he was saying that a lot of guys from 30 to 45 are experiencing just a malaise of not wanting to pursue their wives, not wanting to pursue anything, just wanting to go home every day and watch TV.
Because change is uncomfortable.
Well, and to me, that sounds like depression. To me, it sounds like a nihilistic, I just don't, what's worth living? What's worth doing? Why would I strive to make myself better? Why would I put energy into my wife? It's all the same. It's just, I go home every night and I watch 4 hours of TV, and then I go to bed and I watch YouTube, and maybe I make love to my wife once every 3 months, and maybe I play with my kids every now and then, but it just sounds like hell.
Yeah.
And that's hell to me. Yeah. That's just hell. And you see men all the time who live this life and this malaise. And I think that's what Senior pushes back against. So that's the hard thing with Lord Lundy, is that on the one hand, I completely agree. When men cry, it should be weighty.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's the best way to put it, because I'm not saying that men should never cry, because men should cry and we should have emotions and we'll have big emotions. And I mean, I almost teared up when Rowdy mentioned that story just because it's so beautiful, this act of mercy that he shows to his son. But there's something improper about men in a place of power crying. And there's something unsettling for the family when they see the head of the family cry. And it should be an unsettling experience when you witness your dad cry for the first time at his dad's funeral or at his mom's funeral. That's how you know it's weighty. Or when you're getting married and he cries tears of joy for you.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. That's weighty. That means something. But you need your father to be stalwart, to be a man who is not moved by the seasons, to be a man who is constant.
Or if he is moved and he's visibly moved by something, I think it's such a important thing for like a child. If a man is more emotional, on more of the emotional side, right? And we're all different. If a child sees that his father is moved to tears, how that man handles that is huge, right? And so you're at a funeral. There's extreme loss. You lost someone so close to you. You are feeling all the feelings, everything, and you start to cry. But having the virtue to just sit there and cry, but also not to lose yourself and just lose all control and weep uncontrollably, right? And that may be necessary in that moment, but I don't know if it is. You should stand there. These feelings are real. Accept them, but this isn't the time for me to show these emotions right now, because this isn't about me. I'm going to put this person before myself and these people around me before myself, and I'm going to control these emotions. I'm going to put them in this box for now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think like funerals are very proper. And on the other hand, I think if you're not crying at the funeral of a loved one, there's a disorder there. And I've witnessed this. One of the first funerals I cried at wasn't until I was in my 20s, and it wasn't a family member. It was when there was a man who was very upstanding in the church. And during his funeral mass, everybody was around. And during the middle of his funeral mass, I just cried thinking about that. The beauty of his life and what he had done, how he had touched all these people, how I hope that I'm someone who can do something similar. Maybe one day there'll be people at my funeral who will speak well of me, who I will have had a spiritual impact on their lives. And I really hope that's true. And so I cried thinking about that, but that was one of the first ones. And because growing up, I had this false idea that everybody goes to heaven.
Yeah.
And so when my grandparents passed away, okay, well, they're just in heaven. There's nothing to cry about here. And so you bottle it up. Maybe not even that. Maybe just go through it. And so I think there's also a deprivation there. There should be tears there. There is a right mourning. You should know how to mourn with other people as well.
Yeah.
And if you don't do that, there's something wrong.
Yeah, like there's true loss when you lose somebody. There's hope. There's always hope, right? And we should never lose touch with that. But there is, something was lost.
Yeah.
And we need to grieve on that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's
a right way to mourn.
Yeah.
Is what I'm saying. And there's two extremes. There's the man who never cries, not even at funerals.
They put those feelings in the box, but they never pull them out and revisit them.
Or maybe they don't. Maybe they never feel it.
Yeah.
And that maybe that's the problem. They've never felt it. And so maybe they didn't have love.
Yeah.
And then there's the other guy who's Lord Lundy, who cries at every single thing. And then his crying doesn't have weight. You should remember the number of times your dad cries, I think. Like seeing my dad cry was a big deal in my life. The first time, I'm like, wow, this is a weighty thing. I've never experienced this before. It happens on rare occasions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, girls are completely different because my wife cries at commercials for a movie. Like in the movie theater, if two old people die in a bedside and it's a Hershey's commercial or something, they share Hershey's and then die.
Yeah.
She's bawling. It's like 2 minutes into this thing.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's proper to women. But there's also, there's a way that men should act, especially in society.
Yeah. And I want to, and this could just be me, I guess, disagreeing with you. I don't know. But I don't want to have a cookie-cutter image of what a man should be when it comes to crying.
Yeah.
Right? Because some men are more emotional. Like some movies that I watch, some of them move me to tears. And mm-hmm. I think being moved to tears is okay.
It is.
Right? But it all comes back to like, I don't want it to move me to tears that I'm just uncontrollably crying and I don't know how to handle these emotions. It's like, no. Like, I'm watching this movie about, I don't know, a war story, and the man is dying valiantly and bravely, and this means so much. Like, an example would be, I watched a movie about, it was some firefighters, and they were wildland firefighters. And I had no idea this story. It was based on a true story. And basically, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen this movie, they almost all die at the end. And they die fighting bravely. And and you see their families, all their families deal with this at one moment. And it just, being a little kind of closely connected to that with my dad being a firefighter, I cried.
Yeah.
It brought tears to my eyes.
I mean, I'm not saying that, like, I might cry at La Boheme. I almost cried at the story. The Lord has worked on me in a lot of ways. And has taken away my heart of stone and given me a heart of flesh. But I'm saying we should be mindful of proper way to do these things.
Yeah.
And we should strive to
being in control of your passions and your emotions. It doesn't fall under the category of like lust and sexual desire. No, you need to be in control of your emotions all the time. You need to strive for that.
We should know how to do this, and the way that we know how to do this is through tradition. And that's what we've lost. We're living in a traditionalist age. We no longer know how to mourn. There's a Greek book by Sohrab Ahmari, who's a wonderful writer, speaker. And he wrote a book called Unbroken Thread, and he speaks about the mourning practices of people in Asia and how, you know, for the first 7 years after the wife dies, she has to wear black every day. She has to do these certain things.
Well, the husband dies.
The first 7 years after the husband dies, the wife does these things. And the point he makes is that, okay, these might sound extreme, and to our society, we might go, well, that's crazy. You shouldn't tell people how to mourn. But conversely, people don't know how to mourn today. We don't know what to do. We don't know when it's too soon to go out. We don't know what we should wear. It'd be so nice to live in a civilization where they said, when your wife dies for 2 years, you wear black. You don't go out to family parties. This is what you do. This is the program you follow. This is how we mourn. This is what helps us make it through. This has been time tested. This is what tradition tells us that we do.
Yeah.
And it gives us a framework for how to do it, because so many people are just lost. There's no framework. It's just do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Go out and do whatever you want. And in that moment, you're so lost and you're so broken that you don't know what to do.
Yeah. And I think a practical way that you can do this in today's world was, an example of that would be, I'm going to butcher her last name, but I think it's Christian Tierney, I think. And she has 10 kids and her husband died from cancer. And I was listening to her on Lila Rose's podcast, and she talks about mourning and how she never really understood the whole wearing black, and she kind of thought it was whatever. But then she started to do it. And she says, I honestly wish I would have done it longer. She was like, because it was something as simple as like, it could be something as simple as like, I'm wearing this black bracelet all the time. Because it's just a sign that I can look at. And it's like, I'm in mourning still. I can allow myself to be sad. I don't have to move on. This is something that is carrying a lot of weight on my heart and my soul. And I can allow myself to mourn. That doesn't have to look like me weeping on the ground. Oh, woe is me. I lost my husband every day. But it allows me to remember him and to be sad that I lost this person that I loved.
Yeah. Here's a framework for how to do it. There's a framework for how to live. You don't have to make it up on your own. We live in such an individualistic society where we always think that we have to make it up on our own. This is how this ought to be done. And the way that things ought to be done in America is do them however you want. And so the idea of wearing black after somebody dies might be completely contrary to an individualistic way of life. A person might hear this and go, well, my husband dies. I'm not going to wear black. I'm going to go out and live and go out and do this or go out and do that or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's sad. So you're making up something, a tradition on your own without any roots in anything, just because it's what you think you ought to do at that moment, instead of listening to the voice of history, the voice of tradition, the voice of generation past who has taught us this is the way that we do things because it's the best thing that we can do for us.
Yeah.
Here is a framework by which you can live. We're living in a society which no longer has given us for a framework by which you can live. Even with with men and women, that's why I kind of balk at the, there shouldn't be cookie cutter versions of men and women. And I'm like, we should strive to be an idealistic man. If you're a feminine man, you should try to be masculine. That is something you should try to do because that is something we ought to do. That's a framework by which we live. And when we don't do that, it leads us into the problems we have with our society, whereas feminine men now think they are literally women, which is crazy. Now, they're not women, but you should cut your hair. You should stop dressing like a slob. You should be a man.
Bro, Jesus had long hair. Yeah.
Like, there's things that you ought to do in your society. You shouldn't wear a dress. You should wear a suit to mass.
Yeah.
Like, you should be a man.
And, I mean, I think the problem with men, the whole thing of men thinking they're women, right, is because maybe they are more feminine men. They don't have those natural masculine traits. And so they should strive to be masculine men, but they haven't been taught on how to use the traits that they have and direct them towards being masculine, right? Because being more of a nurturing guy isn't necessarily bad. It's not probably how it should be, but there's ways that you can direct that in a manly way. And that's all I'm saying is how we don't need to be so legalistic and like idealistic and cookie cutter in the sense that like, oh, I was raised by women. I have more feminine traits than I probably should, right? And
I watched my fair share of chick flicks too. So I've got two sisters.
But chick flicks are, they're today's romances and tragedies and like it's where true love is. Hallmark, come on, man.
I mean, so I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I don't think we're agreeing fully, but this is the idealistic view. And to me, the idealistic view is that men should act a certain way.
Yeah.
There is a cookie cutter, and you should strive to be that because that image is virtue. We're not talking about the man who's going out and slanging his seat. He shouldn't do that. Even if his emotions tell him, go out and spread your wild oats. Yeah. Like, go out and sleep with every girl you want. I would tell him he's being feminine.
Well, I think an example that I could give of like, so for instance, like I said, I think I'm a little too nurturing sometimes to my kids. And I say that in the realm of, I think the virtuous thing, if you're someone who really wants to just spend time with your kids and you want to nurture them and you just want to play and do the baby talk and do all that, that's okay. But I think there's the virtuous way to live that out is to realize that the primary person who should do that is my wife. And I've had to wrestle with that and realize that like if the baby goes to her instead of me, I need to be okay with that because that's a good thing. That means that she is an amazing mother. And the child loves her. That doesn't mean the child doesn't love me.
No.
That's just not my primary role. And it doesn't mean that I can't do those things sometimes. It just means that I shouldn't focus on being that person.
If the baby comes to you before it comes to the mom, there's a deprivation. there's a lot of times there's an issue there because the mom's carried the baby for 9 months. The mom is with the baby all day long. The mom feeds the baby through the night.
And I try to remind myself that if every time I start feeling that feeling of kind of, I guess, the jealousy of my daughter, Noah Kate, going to Marissa before... For me, I take a second. I'm like, no, this is good. This means that my wife has an attachment with our daughter that I'll never have. But it's an amazing attachment. And I pray that that's never lost.
Well, you'll have a different one. And that's the thing. Once you have kids that are a little bit who start getting older. I mean, my daughter's a toddler, so we have our second one. It's a totally different dynamic now between me and my oldest daughter. Mm-hmm. Now I get to be the fun dad also, like tossing her high into the air and playing with her outside and all these things, and also the disciplinarian. And it's a bond unlike you'll ever experience in your life, but it's not the bond of a mother with an infant because that's different, or a mother with a 6 months old because that's totally different. And it should be different. She carried her for 9 months. She's on her every single day. She watches her every single day. She feeds her throughout the night.
Yeah,
like that's what a mom does. She's with her 24 hours a day. There's the skin-to-skin contact is something that a man could never do. And if a man does that and gets in the way of the mom, usually there's a deprivation there with the mom.
Yeah.
Because the man becomes the mom for the kid and becomes the primary attachment. And there's something wrong with that. There's a problem with that because men and women give their child different things. Women are the empathetic one. So what happens when the mom's not empathetic, doesn't teach the kid empathy? They don't learn. And it's not that the dad can come in and fill in that spot, because that's not the role he's supposed to play.
Well, even if the dad does come in and fill that spot, which maybe he can, but it's a give and take. You come in and you fill that role, then you're not fulfilling the role of the father.
Yeah.
Right? And that's why the father and the mother duo is so important, because you bring different things to the table.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so just like we've been talking about controlling your emotions with the tears, with your sexual desires, with all of that, the desire to be nurturing to your children, you shouldn't let that emotion control you, in the sense that you usurp the title of mother from your wife.
Yeah.
You shouldn't do that.
You have a title of father, which is different, which has gravity to it. The son in your story experiences that gravity because he knows his dad will hold the line. If he's not there by 7, dad's giving me bread. Yeah. And that's what makes the mercy that beautiful.
Yeah.
Because there is a way of acting here. There is a dad who is a disciplinarian.
One image that's coming to mind is like, if you're sculpting something, right? The dad is the person who is just, he's lopping off the big pieces. He's drawing the lines. These are out of bounds. You don't do this. This is how this should look. And the mother is the one who chisels here, who chisels there, who kind of gets to know what she's working with and really gets to draw out the true beauty of something. You do the big work, the work that no one else wants to do. And then after that, you have a beautiful work of art, hopefully, God willing, when they get older. And then the dad is the one who gets to lift up that piece of artwork and say, look at this person. Look at this beautiful human being that I've had a role in making.
If we have fragile kids, who are often the ones that are causing fights in schools and all that kind of stuff, if we've got really fragile kids, it's because there's no dad in the home. And if we got kids that no longer know how to love, it's because there's no mom in the home.
Yeah.
And you can be a mom that's in the home and not in the home. And you can be a dad that's in the home and not in the home. If you're constantly pawning your kids off, if you're constantly sitting in front of the TV, you're a parent who's not in the home. And so don't be surprised when they don't know empathy, when they don't know love, when they don't know how to act, when they don't know that between men, the threat of violence is very real. Mm. You learn that from your dad.
Yeah.
If dad's not in the home, you don't know that.
Now, let's just say, maybe we're not getting everything exactly right, right? We're not getting all the roles right or whatever. But when you look out in the world and all the studies that come out that show the effect of not having fathers in homes these days, and how everything is like, it's because like there's no father in the home, and these are the outcomes that happened in these households where there was no father in the home. All of the kids did this. All of the children acted like this. They all have this deprivation in their lives because the father's not there. So having a strong father who's virtuous is super important. And even if he's not perfect, he's not going to be perfect. But having that person in there to fill that role and letting the mother be the mother, is there's something to be said for that. And it may not look exactly how we're saying. You and I probably think it is, but there's something to be said about these roles and how they should be lived. Yeah.
And there's something to be said, if you get nothing else on this podcast, the entire point of what I'm saying is give tradition a shot.
Yeah.
Listen to the voice of the dad who have lived this way for thousands of years, who knew how to raise kids, who knew how to raise family. Give them a shot. You're living in a age of revolution. You're living in an age unlike seen in the history of the universe, where we have forgotten how to eat, we've forgotten how to live, we've forgotten how to discipline, we've forgotten how to love, we've forgotten all these things. If you think the world's great, continue on. I mean, go on. We've caused it to be this way. But if you think it's gone terribly wrong, listen to the voice of your ancestors.
Yeah.
They knew how to live. Now, you might have to go a couple generations back because your parents lost it if they were baby boomers, and their parents before them had it until war came about. They were the greatest generation, and then they went soft on their kids after the war because of everything that had happened.
Yeah.
But listen to your ancestors. Listen to the voice of the dead. There's millions and millions and billions of people who know how to live. But you just have to listen to him.
One thing that Matt Frad has started saying that, and you guys, whoever's listening to this will understand that I'm a big Matt Frad fan.
Me too.
He played a big part in my conversion. But one thing that he started saying that I absolutely love is he says, get married too young and have more kids than you can afford. And that's it. And it's like, that sounds like a very dumb way to go about it, but then again, it doesn't. Like, no, get married too young, because being married to another woman and having to be a spouse will make you more virtuous than almost anything else. And have more kids than you can afford, because children bring so much love into your life.
Yeah. And I agree with him there, except for the only times I wouldn't agree with him, because that's what I tell people when they get married too.
Yeah.
get married young, have too, way too many kids, more than you can afford. Just go ahead and start. But the problem is people can fight the selfless nature of marriage easily. And if you're selfish now and you have kids, it doesn't mean you're going to be a good mother. Just because you have kids, it's not going to automatically turn you into a good mother.
Oh, no.
Not every mother is a good mother.
No, having kids and having a spouse, it forces you to deal with the things that you didn't deal with beforehand.
Yeah.
And if you don't deal with those things, it's going to go down the toilet.
Yeah, you can still choose not to deal with them. You can still choose to be a selfish spouse. You can still choose to be a absent mother or an absent father.
Tyrant father, all
of it. But enter into it. Instead of doing that, enter into it. This is the greatest gift you'll ever have. If you want to have a joyful, happy life, get married young, have more kids than you can afford, live for them. Don't live for yourself. Live for somebody else. Pursue your wife.
Yeah.
Love, love, love.
Yeah, maybe we should just turn this into like a marriage and family podcast.
It'd be great if we had call-ins.
Can you guys just talk about the book?
Could you imagine if wives or husbands called in asking for marriage advice?
Oh, don't ask it for me, bro. Stuff. I'm still figuring it out, dude. I'll
give it, but well, I don't know if people can take it.
No, and all of my previous relationships, I've been the rock, and then I find this amazing woman, and she's the rock, and I'm like, man, I'm messed up. I got to deal with all my crap, you know?
You're like, I prefer the ones who are a little broken.
Yeah, right? Now she's got to fix me.
Yeah. So let's get on to the next part. Our last part is the bad child. Or actually, before we do that, I made a challenge to Rowdy, but he didn't take it on, but I took it on. So I made a cautionary tale that I'm going to read as an act of humility for all of you.
For all of us.
This is a true story, actually, because my cousins, their grandma used to always tell them never to stand by the screen door because she had a cousin who lightning struck them and killed them because they were by the screen door during a thunderstorm. And they never believed it was true until they found
I feel like that's a weird correlation. Like, was it because he was by the screen door?
Yeah. Well, that's what she always said. And so they didn't think it was true until after she died. They were doing an ancestry and they found his tombstone that says killed by lightning. And so here we have Edwin Mann, who stood next to the screen door and was killed by lightning. Edwin was a little boy who played till day was through. He liked to linger here or there and do what any boy would do. He had a love of thunderstorms and would revel at the bang, but his mother always warned her son to be mindful when it came. She said he could watch here or there, even up the stairs next to the window or in the shed. He could watch them even from his room while lying in his bed. He just could not watch them by the door where everyone came in. The screen, however, was the perfect place for a rambunctious boy to land. Until it hit that dreadful day when watching from the door, all of a sudden bang and flang and flew across the floor. The only left was a shoe still standing smoking in that place. If you know, you ought to imagine the look on his mother's face. And to this day, the epitaph rings true for all to see. Here lies Edwin Mann, killed by lightning. And so that is the story of Edwin Mann. That's a true story. So I kind of liked it. As soon as they've been telling me that story for years, and we found his tombstone in our cemetery.
Have you sent that to any of them?
Yeah.
They'd probably love it.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
I'm sure they, because it's just, it was very well written, and the rhymes were great, and it's a true story, so it probably hits even harder.
Yeah. It was fun, because it's one of these stories. I mean, it's their grandma had been telling them for years, and she was super eccentric and very lovely woman. I loved her. And so they just thought she was making it up.
Yeah.
So she dies and they find the tombstone killed by lightning. So
I don't ever listen to her. I've been standing by screen doors my whole life.
Exactly. Well, that was what I was thinking about the boy who ate the string and died. I'm like, wait, is this a thing?
Oh, yeah.
Because he had better stop eating string. Well,
Marissa had a dog that ate string and it ties around their intestines of some sort and it'll kill them.
That's wild.
Yeah. And so she was always stressed out, you know?
That's crazy. So then we have the Bad Child's Book of Beast, which I love. And Roddy, what did you think of it?
It wasn't what I thought it was after, because the book, it's a little book and it just goes from cautionary tales to the Book of Beasts. And I thought it was going to be more of like, here's some cautionary tales about these beasts and here's what you should learn from. Like when the passage that Caleb read at the beginning of the podcast about like the kangaroo and you shouldn't hop like a kangaroo or whatever, I thought it was going to be more like that. But it kind of just turns into him just describing animals.
Yeah.
So there's no like moral, like it's called the Bad Child's Book of Beasts,
mm-hmm.
but there's no moral for the bad kid.
Yeah.
Right. And I found that strange and I didn't enjoy it as much as I enjoyed cautionary tales, honestly.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I liked it because I've been starting to enjoy poetry now.
Yeah.
And it's all about the imagery. And so with poetry, you're kind of painting a picture. And that's all this book does. This part of the book just paints a picture of the animal using the imagery of the words. And so one example would be the lion. The lion, he dwells in the waste. He has a big head and a very small waist, but his shoulders are stark and his jaw, they are grim, and a good little child will not play with him. And so that tells you a lot right there to me. Is he's got a really big head. He's got a small waist. He's got a very small waist. He's got really strong jaws, and you shouldn't mess with them.
Yeah.
And so it just describes, and that's how they all are. So the next one is the tiger. The tiger, on the other hand, is kittenish and mild. He makes a pretty playful for any little child, and mothers of large families who claim to common sense will find a tiger well repay the trouble and expense.
That one was funny, because that one's basically saying, yeah, get yourself a tiger, mom of 10 kids, and you know, you might get one taken off your hands, exactly. You know, lighten the load a little bit.
Yeah, that was the funny. And the image is like, there's a kid and there's a lion at first, and then all of a sudden there's a lion and there's no kid.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And I think this one, to me, this one's more playful than the cautionary tales.
Yeah, it is.
He's just playing around with these different images. Like, there's one about a giraffe and how their heads are so high, and how in order to shoot them in the head, you'd have to jump out of a plane in a parachute, you know? And so it's
just delightful to think about.
Yeah.
Well, and they're true. There's something true. Like, even the tiger, there is a difference between a tiger and a lion. And the difference is that there is more of a cat nature to the tiger, at least that you imagine oftentimes.
Yeah.
And so that's something that's true. You almost imagine lions like dogs and tigers like cats. Or at least that's always been my assumption, even though it's not true, you know, scientifically. Yeah. Or one of my favorite ones was called The Camel, The Ship of the Desert.
And that's it.
And that's it. and it really tells you a lot about the camel. What are they used for? You know, people travel on them. They pack them out. Yeah. They are literally the cargo ship of the desert.
Yeah.
That's what a camel is.
And so it's just little funny descriptors of animals. And that honestly would be a fun, even though I failed to do this writing project, it would be fun to do that, of just pick an animal and just describe them in a playful way.
Yeah.
Right. And that's something that, I don't know if Belloc was like that, but I know that people say that G.K. Chesterton was like that. He was just playful, right? He was smart and witty, but he was also playful. Like, he has I haven't read it, but I want to, the little philosophy about cheese. Where he writes this whole essay about why philosophers and scientists don't talk enough about cheese. And he's all serious about it, but it's obviously him just being playful. You know?
Well, and it's true, because what is more true to say about the camel? That he is a ship of the desert, or that he's a quadruped that has two humps, or sometimes one hump. The hump is completely full of fat, and it has this chromosomes and this, and it has this scientific name. What tells you a better story about the camel? That he's a quadruped? That he's got four legs? Or that he's the ship of the desert.
Yeah, when you say the ship of the desert, it's like, okay, so what does that mean? Oh, so it's something that goes in the desert. What happens on a ship? It carries things. So it's something that carries something through the desert. I know it's an animal, so it probably walks, and it's carrying people and things through the desert. And you get that image from the ship of the desert, right?
Yeah, it tells you the primary function of him.
And it's the whole idea, too, of we've talked about it before, of why stories matter, in the sense that you can be told what courage means. But hearing someone being courageous, it's not as legalistic, and you don't get the definition, but you understand it more.
Yeah. Well, in the Aesop's Fables, there was a story of the camel, and they didn't know what he was at first, and then he was, you know, they were terrified of him, and then they come around him when they realize he's not going to eat him, and then they quickly make him his slave.
Yeah.
And that's what he becomes, the ship of the desert. But at first, they might not know what he is, but this gives you the best representation of what the camel is. Just like women aren't, you know, an XX or an XY chromosome, whatever that means. I'm not good at science. They're sugar and spice and everything nice. that like Michael Knowles says, that makes much more sense as to what a woman actually is. Although, yes, of course, women, you know, have certain female body parts and men have certain male body parts, and those shouldn't be altered with, of course. But what tells you more about a person? Yeah. We don't, you know, just look at them.
And that's something that was really fascinating to read when I was reading Father Bethel's book about Senior. Was him talking about, it's this whole idea of why, like, science isn't bad. We've had so many great things come from science, but our whole world is based on science now. Mm-hmm. We look at everything in a scientific fashion, right? We break everything down to the chromosomes. We see a tree. We say, okay, so there's photocells in there that absorb the sunlight, and they make this, and they make that, and you lose the ability to look at something for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tree that's growing in this forest, and it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it's a house for birds, mm-hmm. right?
And I can lay under it and take a nap.
Yeah, and it produces shade, and it gives me pleasure, right?
Fire.
We we lose the artistic and the poetic knowledge of things.
Yeah.
And that's such an and that's why, even though these things seem kind of dumb or kind of unimportant, they are important, because they're teaching our mind to look at the world in an imaginative way and to fall in love with God's creation. And that's huge. And something as simple as the ship of the desert helps us to do that. It forces us to use our imagination.
Yeah.
And wonder, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely. And so next week we're going to be, or in 2 weeks we'll be back once again with La Boheme, which is going to be great. We're going to go see La Boheme soon. I've just been humming the different songs in my head, and it's been a fantastic experience of that. So we hope you'll enter into that with us as well.
We're going to have some special guests on this episode.
We will, yeah.
Yeah, tune in to find out.
I know, gosh.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah, it's going to be something. Uh-huh. No, it's going to be wonderful. It's going to be great. Our wives are going to be joining us, so that'll be really great. They're going with us to La Boheme, of course. It'd be kind of weird if it was just you and me at an opera.
Would it, though?
Well,
it'd be all right.
It'd be all right.
It would. I mean, obviously, sugar and spice and everything nice. They make everything better.
Exactly.
But yeah, it's going to be good. I'm excited. I've never done anything quite like this. I've seen plays and I've participated in plays, but never an opera. And so this seems something, and it's like, we're going to get dressed up. This is something formal. We're going to go out to eat. We're going to go do this thing, and it's going to be fun. So I'm excited. I'm excited to talk about it and how it affected me. And, you know, maybe Caleb will shed some manly tears. Who knows?
Yeah, I might.
Yeah, so we'll see you guys next time. And never forget that we were made for the stars, yet planted in the soil. See you.